the road must have a code that you can live by, and so become yourself, because the past is just a goodbye. Teach your children well. Their father's hell did slowly go by, and feed them on your dreams, the one they picked, the one you know by.
Hello, this is your host for Education Now, Athena Melville, and I'm welcoming you to this February 17th podcast of the second half of Dr. Stephen Krashen's address to the symposium at Mary Collins Charter School in Petaluma, California, this past January of 2011. Dr. Krashen is Professor Emeritus at USC here in California. In this address, he covered reading, writing, poverty, libraries, skills, tests, and he comments on the bogus, which is his term, STEM crisis. Dr. Stephen Krashen is an outspoken advocate for children and teachers. Remember, you can always send comments and or questions to hermes@pacific.net, or please link to us from our Facebook page. And now we'll get started with Dr. Stephen Krashen and the second half of his address.
Okay, if we're not going to use rewards, what do we use? What do? Well, how about reading itself? Reading itself by far is the best way to encourage reading. Students who are engaged in sustained silent reading programs at the end of the year are reading more. Even over time, Vincent Greeney's research, if you look at kids in elementary school who do sustained silent reading, you look at them again in high school, they're still reading more. Sometimes one book can do it. Jim Trelease, our hero, the author of the Read Aloud Handbook. How many of you know the Read Aloud Handbook? My mother read the Read Aloud Handbook. My perfect, wonderful mother. She said to me, "Stephen, why can't you write like this?" I wish I could. My gosh, is it good. Anyway, in the last edition of the Read Aloud Handbook, he brings in a concept called the home run book, which he got from Clifton Fadiman. He says, one reading experience can make a reader. Okay? Fadiman said, your first book, your first kiss, your first home run are always the best. My first home run was the best. It was also my last. I'm not a complete nerd, you know, I work out all this, I do that stuff. And I don't mind getting into a ball game every so often. I was in a baseball game last spring. I was pitching. I had a no-hitter going for 5.5 innings. Then the bell rang and the big kids came out. We decided to test out Trelease's idea of the home run book. And we looked at it. My students and I did the work. They did the work. I got the credit. Our papers are on the website. We looked at children grades 5 through 8, and we asked them one question. Is there one book that got you excited about reading? Yes. Anywhere from 50 to 80% of the sample said yes, and they told us the name of the book in many cases. Garfield, I Found Something Better Than Television. Captain Underpants Changed My Life. You want subversive literature, check it out. Okay, it's amazing. Joanne Ogier, one of my former students, looked at the books they mentioned. There were practically no award winners. I think there was one Newbery winner, no Caldecott winners. Kids have very different ideas as to what good literature is. They like series books, stuff like this. Literature, oh yes. I believe in literature. I think literature is applied philosophy. How are we supposed to live? Ethics. Why are we here? Okay, known as metaphysics. Literature is sometimes the only way you can discuss some of these issues, which is why religion always uses parables. It's the only way we can discuss a lot of this stuff. Free reading and literature work well together. free reading, the more they read on their own, the better prepared they'll be to understand, appreciate what we recommend. And we know a literature program is working when children read more on their own. That's the whole idea. Read alouds are part of this. Jim Trelease is right. Children who are read to regularly outperform children on any test you throw at them compared to kids who don't or aren't read to regularly. Read alouds work for several reasons. Trelease points out you're hearing things slightly above your oral level, and that helps you acquire the literary language, and kids get excited about books. If you've ever worked in elementary school, if you've ever been to elementary school, you understand this. The teacher reads Charlotte's Web to the class. The book disappears from the school library, disappears from the bookstores. You can't find a copy anywhere. Children read Charlotte's Web 5, 10, 15, 20. They memorize Charlotte's Web. Stuart Little, then Trumpet of the Swan, and then, if we're lucky, someday onto still America's greatest living writer, Judy Blume. Still the champion. Are you there, God? It's me, Margaret. Right? When this happens, most of our school problems are solved. Now, this is warm-up. The real issue, of course, is access to books. Yeah, I know. You can lead a horse to water, you can't make him drink. Of course, this is true. But you know what? Given water, all horses drink eventually. All of them. They don't drink when we want them to, okay? But they do. And my hypothesis, based on the research, is that given truly compelling reading material, given comprehensible reading material, nearly everyone reads. People like to read. Kids like to read. We have this view that nobody's reading anymore, that there's been a decline in literacy. This happened when a report came out called Reading at Risk. By the way, people have been saying this since recorded history. Kids these days, arguments. I responded to Reading at Risk. It was a government report saying how nobody was reading anymore. I got lots of press, the original report, because everyone believed it. And they set up commissions and all this. I wrote a report saying that they had distorted the data really seriously. I got this nasty note from the feds about how I was over-complacent. What's wrong with you? Then the next report, they quietly said, never mind, reading's perfectly fine. There's been a sudden reversal. But that one came out on a Friday afternoon where no one paid any attention. The latest chapter of all this is a paper I just finished and submitted to the English Journal, where if it's published, maybe four people will see it. This is our scientific responsibility. And it's called Stop Scolding High School Kids. The data is here, and I'd like to go through this with you briefly so you see what's going on. Kids say we're not reading. Well, the most conservative measure of reading is book reading. There's been no change. If you look at the first chart where it says percent of respondents who said they read a book yesterday, no change since 1946. Pretty much the same. They didn't include that. Average number of minutes a day reading, another way of looking at this. If you look at books, pretty much the same since 1946, 22 minutes, down to 14, up to 24, then 21 minutes. Magazine and newspaper, that's gone down. That's gone down for the whole population. We're focusing on high school. Websites, way up. This is reading off the computer. All uses of reading combined, again, pretty much the same. There's been some up and down, but there's been no dramatic change. So what we want to do is look a little closer at what's going on with the computer. And here's my chart based on Pew reports of internet, what kids do on the internet. Email, they don't email. They do text message, okay? And you know all about that. Okay? Connie, you're my BL, okay? I know all about that, yes. Social, look at this. This is Facebook. Way up. This is reading and writing, folks. A lot of instant messages there. Games, yeah, but not like social interaction. The next chart compresses these two. And look at 2009. Kids are doing more computer stuff for interaction, reading and writing, than they are for YouTube and games and stuff like that. I do lots of YouTube, but it's mostly Crazy Frog and SpongeBob with the grandchildren. A lot of fun. Anyway. Now, I do admit, I'm going to conclude the jury's out on this. There's no real evidence of decline. We still need to look a little more carefully. When students, high school students, are doing text messaging, which, by the way, has no negative impact on reading, writing, accuracy, several studies have shown this, when they do Facebook and they go back and forth, what they're reading is not Beowulf. I know that. What they're writing are not deep, interpretive essays on the causes of World War II. Okay? They're doing a lot of reading and writing, and it's not obvious to me that this is bad. It might be very, very good, because it includes lots of mature writing, lots of mature reading, And look at it this way. Let's say we're back in 1920, my hotel is. And let's say we find a group of teenagers in Petaluma who are writing notes to each other. They've gotten into a tradition of writing long messages and talking about their feelings and their problems and their action. I wonder why Susie would talk to you this morning, you know, stuff like this. We would say this is a very interesting literate group. There is more reading and writing going on today with young people than in the history of civilization. It is not obvious to me that this is a bad thing. Writing makes you smarter. We have not looked at the topics and what they do with it and the problems they solve, but I think it is quite possible that this is really a breakthrough for the human race. This could really, really be something. So there's no obvious reason for a decline, but there is a problem that is not considered, and that is the problem of access to books. This is big. Children of poverty. And I know this is not a high poverty area, but I'm going through this for a very good reason that will become obvious as we work. Children of poverty have practically no access to books, practically none. They have no books at home, very few. They live in neighborhoods where there are few bookstores. Public libraries and school libraries are nearly non-existent, very poorly stocked. And there's a good reason I bring this up. Their only source of books for children of poverty is the school library. Isn't this interesting? That's it. The school library has been the most neglected aspect of school. It's the first to be cut. California has zero respect for school libraries. They never even thought about it. But if you're going to talk about improving schools, this is where it starts. Let me give you a little bit of summary of the research on school libraries, which I'll return to several times before we end. First of all, children get their books from libraries. If you ask a child where to get the book they're now reading, anywhere from 33 to 99% will say some school library, depending on the study. Number two, and this is my recommendation for your next bumper sticker and t-shirt, the better the school library, the higher the reading scores. Can I repeat that? The better the school library, the higher the reading scores. This has been shown in many studies. I've participated in this research, and now it's time to do the Keith Currie-Lance test. I'd like to know how many of you heard of this guy, Keith Currie-Lance. Okay, three librarians and one educated citizen. Four librarians, yeah, exactly. Keith Currie-Lance is the golden boy of the American School Library Association. In the 60s, he's still the golden boy, okay? He's everywhere. He's the hero. He's in all the conferences, names everywhere, for good reason. In 1992, Lance was asked by the state of Colorado, he works for the state, to answer the question, is literacy a problem we should throw money at? The answer is yes. We have to aim carefully. He found for libraries in Colorado, the amount of money put into the school did not increase reading scores. No correlation. But if you put the library into the equation, then you see it. Investment into the library, that results in better reading. And he boiled it down to three factors. Books, the presence of a credentialed librarian, where California is by far last in the country, and staffing. It's been determined that half of what school librarians do can be done by anybody. So when we add staff and support, that frees up the librarian to do things that really count, gives the librarian time. Interact with faculty, deal with children. Let me tell you about my fantasy life. You work in a school with a terrific school library. That's the hardest part of the fantasy in California because it's so underfunded. You have a school librarian whose credential loves children, loves books, which is the case all over the place. A child comes in reluctant or wanders into the library. The librarian can get up because the librarian has time. Talks to the child, helps the child find a home run book. A lifetime reader. You've changed the universe for that one child. This is what can happen. Now let's get into the politics, and I will come back to the library situation. Okay, just the right comment at the right moment. There are children of poverty here, okay? But predominantly it is not, but I know there's a pocket of it. And I'm going to use that figure for my own advantages very soon. We are told in the United States that our schools are broken over and over. Now everybody believes it. We are told that teachers don't know how to teach, schools of education are incompetent, the unions are evil, children are lazy, parents don't care. None of those things are true. Absolutely none. Zero. Kids are just as competent as they've ever been, etc. The reason we are told that these things exist is because of our international test scores. Because we're getting beaten by Shanghai, Singapore, right? And they're, you know, developing engineering and all these kids can do quadratic equations and, you know, they're going to rule the world. Well, guess what? None of this is true. None. On the airplane, I read the article about Tiger Mom. Okay? I wrote a letter to Time magazine. Not about the Tiger Mom, who knows. But you know, she backed down from everything she said in the article. Well, it actually didn't quite work out. I have to read the whole article. The statistics they gave are all wrong. They said the United States does middling in international tests. The recent PISA test, we were 17th in reading, we were 26th in math. These other countries are doing better. Well, that's not exactly true. First of all, we were 10th out of 60 countries, if you look at the scores accurately. And we were beaten by three cities. Hong Kong, to my knowledge, is still a city. Shanghai is a province of China. It is not a country. Singapore pretends to be a country, but it's a city. It's a city of only middle class. I've been to Singapore several times. Singapore, the workers come in from Malaysia in the morning. They leave. Okay, they don't take the test. Here's the real thing. If scholars have did this Berliner, Biddle, all their, this whole gang does brilliant research on this. If you look at American students who are middle class, and who attend well-funded schools, they score at the top of the world. Think about this. The reason our average scores are not spectacular is we have a very high percentage of children in poverty. We have, I think, the second highest behind Mexico of all industrialized countries. We have an unacceptably high level of child poverty. It's at least 20%, at least some estimates go up to 40%. Finland, high-scoring Finland, is under 4%. So is Denmark. So is Sweden. They're all around 2, 3, 4 cents. That's the problem. What this means, sports fans, is there's nothing wrong with our schools. The problem is poverty. Here's some data I took out of the PISA report. This is a test given to 15-year-olds worldwide. This is right from their report. It's on your page called The Problem of Poverty. First, you look at middle-class kids who go to schools with less than 10% of the kids in poverty. And that's the case with a lot of middle-class kids. Their average score in the PISA, 551, second highest in the world, right behind Shanghai, where a small percentage of the people take us as kids. We keep getting beaten also, not this time, but past years, we keep getting beaten by countries like Liechtenstein, where like five kids take the test. Iceland, you know, come on, population 100,000, you know, please. This is not a threat to our economic dominance. 10 to 25% of kids in poverty, this is on 10, 527, also way up top of the world. The problem is poverty. That's all it is. The administration says, cure education, you cure poverty. It's the other way around. I was really interested in Martin Luther King's birthday because all the educators, the Ernie Duncan gang, honored Martin Luther King but had no idea what he said. Martin Luther King said, the problem is poverty. You don't improve education, you improve poverty. And he said something very interesting. He says, what we want is full employment. We want everyone to have a decent job that they like and to make an honest living from the job. Now, in terms of American capitalism, this may never happen because it is not profitable to business when everyone's employed. But let's say that's the goal. But until we get there, here's what I would recommend if I ran the zoo. And by the way, the National Council of Teachers of English is working on their policy statement, and they asked members to submit policy recommendations. Here's what I wrote, co-authored with Susan Ohanian. By the way, I do highly recommend, if you're going to do anything, check out susanohanian.org. Get on her mailing list. This is an order. Do it. She is the center of gravity. All of this stuff. She wrote a book called Whatever Happened to Recess. Okay. Her husband, by the way, wrote this stunning book about Albert Einstein called Einstein's Mistakes. And it's all about the creative process. It's amazing. Anyway, we wrote a letter. Our policy statement was this. We cannot discuss curriculum policy. We cannot discuss teacher, teacher education, teacher evaluation. The only thing we can discuss before we move on is poverty. Our first job is to protect children against the effects of poverty. That's number one. Now, what does poverty do to kids? It does several things. Food. Quantity of food, quality of food. Ohanian says, no child left unfed. That's a good bumper sticker. Now, this is the one place we agree with Ernie Duncan, because they are making efforts, and they do understand the importance of free and reduced breakfast, lunch, etc. So this we all agree with. Now, second is health care. Children of poverty live in families that either are not insured or have a very high deductible. So the health care reform, again, was a really good step forward, and I, of course, think the public option is absolutely necessary. I'm sorry to see it go. Because right now, if you've got a job, you get covered. They're the people who need it less than the people who aren't working. Okay. Now, the third is environmental toxins. And here, the story is all about lead poisoning. The good thing about hunger, if you can say the good thing, is that it's reversible. If children are food deprived and you give them a good diet, they're going to make a good recovery. They're going to be okay. Not true with lead poisoning. The environment of the poor is loaded with lead. We know this. And lead finds its way into the nervous system, takes the place of calcium in the neurotransmitters. And once it's there, it's there. You can't get it out. It's permanent. It causes learning problems. It causes behavior problems. Does that sound familiar? This is the problem. The final one, of course, is our business. And this is books, access to books. Let me tell you what we know about children in poverty and books. I briefly mentioned this. Two studies I'll tell you about. One was one we did a few years ago. We looked at children in three areas. I'll tell you about two of them. Beverly Hills and Watts. Can you imagine? We first asked children how many books they had in their home that they could access and read that were their own or their brothers and sisters. Beverly Hills, the average was 200. Watts, and that's not crazy. That's what my kids grew up with. That's what my grandchildren have. I'll show you pictures later. Watts, 0.4, less than one. School is not leveling the playing field. School is making things worse. We asked them about classroom libraries. We looked at classroom libraries. The average classroom library in Beverly Hills, 400 by Chinese books. In Watts, 50. Look at this. The average child in Beverly Hills has four times as many books in their home as these kids have in their classroom libraries. School libraries were better in Beverly Hills, of course. Public libraries, bookstores. Now, Susan Newman and her colleague went beyond our study in the Reading Research Quarterly a few years later, did this really beautiful analysis of schools in Philadelphia and print environment. Let me give you a quick bunch of headlines from their study. In the poor neighborhoods, the only place you could buy books was drugstores. Nothing for the child older than seven. In the rich neighborhoods, bookstores everywhere. The children were deluged with books. In the poor neighborhoods, the school libraries did not have a librarian, and we see from Keith Lance that this is an independent predictor of scores. The school libraries were not as well outfitted, of course, supplied. The public libraries in the rich neighborhoods had prudential librarians. In the rich neighborhoods were open 7 days a week, six evenings a week. In the poor neighborhoods, they were open maybe one evening a week and maybe a couple of hours on Saturday. The difference between rich and poor is gigantic. I'd like to conclude all this by telling you about a recent study that Anna and Connie encouraged me to get published, thank you very much, which I think is probably the most important work I've ever been connected with. I'm about as excited about this as anything I've ever worked on. I told you about the recent PISA exams. Let's talk about pearls. Pearls, PISA is given to 15-year-olds, pearls is given to 10-year-olds, 40 countries in the world. When the PISA and pearls come out, all these things, the newspapers go nuts. Everyone declares a reading crisis in all the countries. Everyone except Finland, because they always come out first. Okay? You know, Korea is worried about losing to Japan. England is worried about France and all this stuff. And the politicians all start arguing for more skills, more skills, more skills. Oh, boy. Well, we didn't do this. I did this with Steve Lee and Jeff McQuillan, my former students, and 15, 20 years later, was still hanging in there and doing the research on email, going back and forth. Anyway, here's what we found. We looked at predictors of how well kids did in this reading test. It was given to kids in 40 countries in their own language, and they do all this statistical magic to make sure the scores are about equal. You know, the tests are fairly equal difficulty. What are the predictors? Number one, poverty. Of course, huge. Large impact, negative. You find this in all studies. The higher the poverty, the lower the score. Okay? Then we looked at the percentage of children in each country who did free reading in school, SSR. This was modest, positive. We then looked at libraries. Access, the percentage of children of 10-year-olds who had access to a school library of 500 books or more. Here's the big moment today. Libraries, large, positive, nearly as large as the impact of poverty. And we used a technique here called multiple regression, which is still legal in California, where each of these predictors is independent. We know that richer countries will have better libraries. This pretends it's not true. Everything is equal in that. This is it. What this suggests is that libraries can mitigate the effect of poverty in terms of access to books and reading. We then looked at instruction, the amount of time devoted to reading instruction. It was modest and negative. Whoa. Now, this could be because poor readers get more instruction, or it could be the instruction doesn't do any good. My conjecture is the graph would look like this. From zero to a little bit, instruction is probably helpful. Like in terms of phonics, we've concluded that basic phonics, alphabetics, we call it, the rules kids can remember, probably a good idea. After that, diminishing returns, where the intensive, systematic, every single phonics rule ever done is not doing anybody any good. Overall, it says on the handout, I'll tell you what this means, R squared equals 0.63. What this means is that if you go to a country, get to look at the data, and you know the level of poverty, you know whether the kids are allowed free reading, whether they have access to libraries and instructional time. This is 63% of the data you need to predict their reading score. For educational research, this is science fiction, this is X-Files. Usually in educational research, you get R squared of 0.2. You explain 20% of time. There's so many other factors. This is enormous. Now, after we did our study, we discovered there was a California study that found the same thing. This is a California librarian named Doug Achterman, and I've listed his data here. And his data that's the most interesting is in grade 11. He found in California what we found for 50 countries, 40 countries. Now, the impact of the library in grades 4 and grade 8 is a lot less, you'll see. That's because California has such lousy libraries in elementary school. It wasn't enough data to get a sufficient amount of variation. But if you look at his data, here's what he found, where the test is U.S. history in grade 11 and language arts. Once again, poverty was a huge factor. In the chart I have here is the first chart, as you see, the beta, the number showing the impact is 0.51. Library, nearly as high, 4.6. School factors, positive, but pretty low. R squared, nearly as high as we got, 0.57. The same result came out, and I have where you can access Doug's stuff. I have his dissertation and all there, where you can find it on the next page. The same result has come out of several European studies where they found that books in the home is an independent predictor and is about as large as poverty mitigated. So this is my political platform here. If nominated, I will not run. If elected, I will not serve. But this is the platform, these things. How do we pay for it? Reduce testing. In your pamphlet, I have an article for you called NUT. No unnecessary testing. Here's the logic. Our responsibility as educators is to test as much as we need to and no more. I'm not saying get rid of all tests. I'm saying there are too many of them and they don't do the right things. Our knee-jerk reaction is problem in education, we'll have a new test. As a result, we keep getting more and more and more and more. The amount of testing being done now, planned by this administration, is unbelievable. Let me tell you what I have read in their documents. I have a hard time talking about this because I sound paranoid. I sound like I'm talking about conspiracy theories like Oswald or 9/11. It has that same feeling, okay? But I'm really giving you a very small amount of what I really know. It's much worse than what I'm telling you. In the blueprint, which is from the administration, and I wonder if I'm the only person in the country, including Arne Duncan, who's actually read the blueprint. Here's what it says. Let me compare what they say to what we're doing now with No Child Left Behind. NCLB, right? No corporation left behind, right? You remember that? Now, NCLB, here's the testing we've got to do with NCLB. California does more than it has to. Okay? Kind of like the dog doing tricks when the master's not. We require, NCLB requires testing at the end of the year, grades 3 through 8, and once in high school. And it's a summative test. It's at the end of the year, and it's in reading and math. This is what we got now. Everyone agrees it's too much. The current administration says it's too much. Everyone agrees. They're going to increase this by 10. First of all, they want value-added testing. Value-added testing means you have a pre-test and a post-test, and you look at the difference, and this is how you evaluate teachers. We know mathematically the studies on value added show that it is complete garbage. The scores are very, very unreliable. They bounce around. It really is not a good measure, even if the tests were valid. But they still want to do it because they're pretty much immune to empirical studies. If you do value added, you can't just use the spring test because you got summer. And kids make gains during the summer and loss and all this. So this doubles it. We're going to have pre-test and post, okay? Pre and post. Okay? Not only that, we're going to have, oh gosh, formative tests. Now, formative is a word that has been hijacked. Formative testing really means what teachers do all the time. Every teacher does formative testing and has a pretty good idea where your kids are at because you're constantly working with them. That's real formative testing. The feds have taken this word, they use it in interim testing as well. They want tests through the year. They want tests computer-driven that are tightly linked to the standards and which are becoming the national curriculum. And they've said this. When they started talking about standards, all of us knew it was going to be tests, and it was. They've announced we're having all these tests, is what I'm telling you. Arne Duncan has said we want to be able to say where every child is, where they are right now in all their subjects through, let me run through this, through interim testing linked to the syllabus. So, in fact, one document says they want to do it every day. And they say this is great feedback for teachers. Oh, come on. If you're a teacher and you need a federal daily interim test to see where your kids are, there's something seriously wrong. There's not a single teacher saying, please, let us do these tests. Please, we need them because we don't know how much our kids are learning. No, nobody is saying that. Okay, that's more. Not only that, we're doing reading and math. They want to expand it to all subjects. Diane Ravitch came back from a meeting with the Department of Education, all the officials, and she said, they want to test everything. And the professional organizations are jumping on the bandwagon. Let's test everything. The social studies teachers want to be tested. We want a syllabus. We want our standards. We want the tests. The science teachers are saying, we want to be tested. That's everything. Everybody wants to be tested because they think they're going to get federal money. Okay, if they do, it's going to be $2.25. Okay. Let me go through this. Okay? Otherwise, I'll forget where I am. Then we'll have to go through the coffee joke. Okay. So we're increasing. They want to do it younger and older. They talk about cradle to job preparation testing. Now, here's the problem with all this. Number one, it's going to cost billions and billions and billions of dollars. We haven't even begun with the test construction. This is all. Duncan calls this heavy lifting. Whenever he says heavy lifting, it's going to cost a lot of money. You can bet on it. Number two, schools need the money for other things. My niece teaches in North Carolina. High poverty. The bathrooms are usually lack toilet paper. The science labs don't have equipment. The library is a joke. The kids come without breakfast half time. And they're going to solve the problems by adding tests. Give me a break. And here's the evidence that it doesn't work. David Berliner has been the hero on this. Berliner is awesome. He's wonderful. He's from Arizona. And he points out, his studies show that states that do more standardized tests with high stakes do not outperform those with less. There's no correlation. Two studies came out last year, and they looked at predictors of college success. They put in several predictors. One was high school grades. They found that high school grades was a powerful predictor of college performance, college completion, everything. And it didn't matter what high school you went to. Adding SAT added nothing to the predictive power. It's a waste of time. The best evaluation we have now, most efficient, is teacher evaluation.
Yes.
It does everything the testers want. It's multiple measures. Watch out for multiple measures. When we say it, we know what they mean, but they hear more standardized tests. You want multiple measures? We'll give you four tests of reading, comprehension, and vocabulary, okay? Six tests of math. That's their idea, but be careful of that one. Well, teacher evaluations, multiple measures. You want to measure growth, teachers take that into consideration. You want to test all subjects, teachers evaluate on just about everything. It's right there, and it's professionals who know the children very well, not a distant stranger who, to paraphrase Susan O'Hanian, wouldn't know a child if one bit him on the leg. Okay? So it does absolutely everything. If we're going to go with the idea of no unnecessary testing, we want to do the minimum. They say, oh, we need the test so we know how we're doing. Fine. You want a test? I got a test for you. We already use it. Let's keep it. It's called the NAEP. The NAEP is a standardized test given to kids every 3 years or so, 2 years, It's given in reading and math, and it can be proven or done and expanded. That's fine with me. It's not given every year. It's not given every grade. It's given twice in elementary school, once in high school. That's all. It's given to samples of children. No child takes the whole thing. And maybe a few thousand take it in each state. So a tiny percentage ever even see this test. To me, it's like doing jury duty. You know, you show up, you do your thing, and occasionally, maybe once in school, you'll be asked to take 40 minutes of one standardized test at zero stakes. This is not a big deal. From there, we can extrapolate and get a pretty good idea of how kids are doing in every area. When you go to the doctor, they don't take all your blood. They take a sample. Now, in terms of money, and I'll stop in a minute or two, how are we going to pay for this? Well, look at what we're spending now. Look at No Child Left Behind. No Child Left Behind, we know, was a total failure. Everybody knows this. Everybody agrees. They keep saying it. It cost $26 billion a year of federal funding. Let's take 2 years of this. Let's make $50 billion. Take the money, invest it in a trust fund. Even at today's low interest rates, it would generate enough money to make sure every child in poverty in the United States has access to a quality library filled with books. Over time, we would have far more than enough. I divided the questions into categories, and I'll try to distinguish my professional opinion from my opinion, unprofessional opinion. The first category has to do with programs, specific programs that come in. The problem with programs is that they have one motivation, and that's profitability. Richard Ellington is the former president of the International Reading Association. He's a very interesting guy. I admire him a lot. He's really good. And he scolded the publishers in this public meeting. They're all in the audience. And he says, you guys, you don't care. All you want to do is put out lots of consumable materials and make money. You don't care if kids learn. And one guy raised his hand and said, so what's your point? Of course, now, there's a wide range in the publishing. There's a publishing industry. There's a wide range. There are people in the publishing industry who are completely dedicated, who are really, really interested in the welfare of kids, no question. And there are those who are simply out for money. So we got to watch out. All the materials are a mixed bag. A question came up on Lexiles. I did an article on Lexiles in the California School Library Association. The head of Lexiles responded in his journal. So I responded to him. Lexiles is a good example of what Gerald Bracey talked about with technology. Technology makes possible to do things in nanoseconds which shouldn't be done at all. Lexiles is an over-precise measure of reading level. Now, there's nothing wrong with reading levels. They're a vague guide that give you some idea of how hard a text is. They're not very accurate because they don't take into account interest and all the stuff, background, motivation, and all this. But, you know, they're a crude thing, and if you keep it that way, it is one of many things you can look at. But to select books for kids, no. There are several ways of doing it that are a lot better. The child actually trying to read the book. A teacher librarian who likes kids like books made suggestions. That's much, much more powerful. People like Lexiles when they're enamored with statistics and computers. Okay? It's too much. You don't need it. The Phi formula is just as good or whatever you've got or none at all. Okay, so it's one of reading level measures are okay, but don't take them seriously. Then we get programs like Read 180, which has come out, etc. These things are generally mixed bags. They put everything in them. So they can't miss in some ways. So there's a lot of reading, a lot of good stuff, a lot of nice stories, and there's a lot of garbage. Programs, you don't need a program. If you know about literacy and language and how it works, collection of stories, if someone comes up for a beginning teacher with a nice anthology of good stories, it can be helpful. But the money we put into these programs, oh my gosh, and the obeisance we give them is not called for, not justified. So I'm doubtful about all of them. There are a couple of questions about phonics. Let me give you a quick rundown of the issues on phonics, which is, the great phonics debate is still with us. I read that in an article published in 1916. It's been going on for a while. The phonics debate is really three positions about phonics, three possible positions. One is an extreme, there are two extremist views, and one view I think is right. An extremist view is called intensive systematic phonics. which means teach all the rules in a very strict order to all kids. I don't think any practicing teacher I have ever met believes in this. This is a fantasy of McGraw-Hill and the National Reading Panel. There's another extremist position called zero phonics. Teach phonics, go to jail, which is also an extremist view. The evidence supports basic phonics, and that means teach the rules that you can remember, because teachers can't remember all the rules, that kids can learn and apply to text to make text more comprehensible. Basically, initial consonants, few of the vowel rules, after that it's diminishing returns. You can't do intensive systematic phonics because nobody knows all the rules. They're too complicated. Teachers tell me they have to look them up before they come to class. Come on, and they don't work half the time. These are the hard ones, right? Exceptions, etc. So you want to teach the ones that really work. You don't need any program to do this. Sit down, have coffee, sit down with four other beginning literacy teachers, make a list of the rules that you think kids can actually learn, and those are the ones we usually wind up teaching. So the whole thing has been blown over. If you give children intensive systematic phonics, I did a review article of this a few years ago, they do better on tests of decoding, reading words in isolation. They do not do better on tests of reading comprehension. In other words, it helps you read words in isolation. It does not contribute to real reading. Even if you delay the real reading test time later, it's not even a warm-up word. It's not even a beginning stage. Now, all of us, if we were given a list of words to read in isolation, would do fine. Not because we studied phonics, but because we know how to read. A little bit of basic phonics at the beginning is a good idea. Most of our knowledge of phonics is the result, not cause, a profound cause of confusion. So phonics for everybody, the basics, no more. Okay, more questions. I've already lost all my cards. That's very convenient. There was an ESL question, which I'll deal with. Fascinating. The state now says the goal is to redesignate kids after 5 years. Okay. This comes from a misreading of research of Kenji Hakuda and Ginger Collier, which says that it takes from 5 to 8 years for middle school kids, okay, and longer for high school kids, to reach the 50th percentile, which half the kids never do. Okay? So it does take a long time. We shouldn't have reading. We've got to do it by this time. The real problem underlying these kinds of decisions is our obsession with grade to learn, our obsession with grade level. Grade level is arbitrary. It's not in the New Testament, Old Testament, or the National Football League guidelines. None of those things. This is made up by people on the committee. There's nothing sacred about it. And the harder we push to get kids through a program quickly, the longer it takes. This is the irony. The student goes to the Zen master and says, Master, if I study with you, how long will it take me to become enlightened? And the master says, oh, about 10 years. What if I work real hard? In that case, 20 years. What if I do the practices morning and night? In that case, 30 years. Why is it the harder I work, the longer it takes? He says, when you have one eye in your goal, you have one eye for your work. It works out. The faster we push, the more we try to do direct teaching of skills, the longer it takes. Can't push it. That's been the problem with all these things. The internet, let's talk about that in what we call Kindleization, the world. Right now, books still have it all over Kindles. No, because you can read them in the bathtub. You know, you can't do that with Kindle. I was going to say the bathroom. Okay. The plane's landing, you turn off your Kindle. Right now, the book is really a lot better. Kindles are catching up, though. They're really interesting. And someday, there's a very good possibility they might supplant the book. Yogi Berra says it's hard to predict, especially about the future. Okay, so we really don't know what's going to happen with technology. But it could be. But if we want Kindles to work, we've got to be able to afford them. Right now, people who have Kindles are in the upper 7% of the population in terms of income. They're a plaything of the elites and the rich. I like them. I think they're cool. But even I, you know, even you, we hesitate before we buy these things. They cost a lot of money. And you got to buy books and all this stuff. And all, you know, download this and download that. So, and then obsolescence gets up. So we got to make them cheap enough so that every child in poverty can have one. And it can be easily replaced when it's lost, stolen, destroyed. So someday, yes, but if we institute it now, there's an economic divide that we're going to make worse. Okay? The U.S. Department of Ed is dedicated to eliminating print and making everything digital. It is in their technology report. Way premature, as far as I'm concerned. Okay, people have talked about the culture of poverty. Now we're in the my personal opinion section. Okay, I'm drifting away from my educated expertise and we're just talking person to person. There is concern a lot of people have. Poverty is it, okay? I am always upset when the state and the government reports things by racial groups, ethnic groups. It's poverty, man. Poverty swamps all this. Linda Darling Hammond has done studies on this. She's done good studies where you look at these things independently. Once you put poverty into the equation, the racial, ethnic factors are far diminished. They're still there, but poverty just swamps everything. And this is something we can do something about, no question, right away. Okay, we can reduce suffering. There is a culture of poverty. It is the result of poverty. It's not the cause of poverty. This is, goes back to recorded history. In the 1300s, a book just came out in our reading about the dancing craze in Europe. People who start ecstatic dancing until they collapse. And the best explanation is these kinds of outbursts are the result of incredible suffering for undergoing. They had the plague. They had no money. They had starvation. Life was absolutely rugged. And people were leading lives of despair and looking for outlets, some form of ecstasy, some form of satisfaction, and a great deal that goes on in communities of poverty is the result of this. Let's end poverty, and the so-called culture of poverty is pretty much going to disappear, at least the negative aspects that we know about. That's my opinion. It is not based on my expertise. The last group of questions can be organized as, how do we change the world? What do we do within school? What do we do outside of school? This is about 50% influenced by what I know from the research and the opinion. I like Frank Smith's advice. I noticed this is a Frank Smith book here. I think it's terrific. Do a little less of what's bad and a little more of what's good. Because we know every person here is under huge constraints. You have constraints on what you are forced to do by people with more authority, and your time is being massacred. I'm amazed people are here today. You should be in synagogues. So but in general, people are, you know, teachers, my gosh, huge workloads that are increasing all the time, forcing to take on more family responsibilities. This is very, very hard, okay? So changing the world is not so simple. There's very little, a lot of us are totally controlled classroom and what we do. We can do a little less of that stuff. If you're doing 10 minutes a day of spelling, try 9. Multiply that by every student in the district, you've got a lot of stuff to say. See if it makes a difference, okay? Do a little more reading. Support the library. When it comes to committee meetings, vote for library help, staffing for the library. California has been cruel to libraries. We have the least supported school libraries in the country. Right now, the ratio of school librarians to students in the United States is about 1 to 900,000. California, it's 1 to 4,500. If we want to catch Mississippi, it's up to 5,000? 5,060. Sure it's not 5,082? What do you know, Connor? I'm the expert here. You're just former president of the Library Association. What do you know? What's the data? 5,200? It's worse. It's getting worse. That's the problem. Connie knows. Let me tell you. We keep track of these things. Oh, my. We're so far behind every other state. It would take a Marshall Plan to catch Mississippi. So we need more money for libraries, of course, more funding, et cetera, et cetera. The public libraries in California are among the worst country. There's a group called America's Most Literate Cities. We always hit 5 of the bottom cities are California. The other 5 are usually from Texas. We're in this competition race to the bottom. So cities like LA have really very poorly supported school libraries and the worst public libraries last time in the country, I think 3rd from the bottom. So this is everywhere. Look, the California high school exit exam doesn't do any good at all. Everyone here knows this, okay? The studies on exit exams show they predict nothing. They don't predict college success. They don't correlate with anything. They don't predict life success. They're a complete waste. They cost total about $500 million. A public library costs about $1 million a year to run. There are 1,000 of them. You get rid of the high school exit exam, you could, that's half the public library budget for the whole state. We've got the worst ones in the country. Can I whine for a few minutes? Okay. Anyway, I've written letters to the editor about this. They've been published. I talked to Garamendi about it when he was, you know, assistant superintendent. I told all my representatives about it. Everybody's bored. I told Jerry Brown, I've written him about it. There are a number of us concerned about this leaving exam and how much money it's cost. This is where you can cut the budget and make life better at the same time. We're getting absolutely no traction. We can do a little less of what's bad, a little more of what's good, and we can support libraries, of course. Outside of school, let me present this in the parable of the 100 monkeys, which some of you have heard about. It's actually based on a real anthropological study. The story is a complete distortion of the research, but it's much better than the research. So I'll tell you the story. There are these monkeys on these islands, separated by water, and their crop, what they eat all the time, is onions, diet, which they grow on the ground and you eat them. And one little monkey discovered that if you wash it out in the stream, it tastes a lot better. Okay? So she started doing it, her little friends started doing it. And the idea is when 100 monkeys started doing it, the idea spread from island to island. This British guy, Rupert Sheldrake, has this idea that new ideas have reality and subatomic physics and particles. They can really travel. I think it's a little goofy, but it's a great idea. It's a wonderful idea. Anyway, so you need 100 monkeys till you get the crucial level. In terms of our view, we're up to like, we used to be up at monkey number 12, and we're down to 6. We go, wow. The problem is, and I'm going back now, the public and we have very different ideas as to how we learn. This is not just corporate greed that's part of it. We believe in the following. We think this is the best hypothesis. Literacy, vocabulary, grammar, spelling, is the result of reading, not the cause. Knowledge of facts and concepts is the result of trying to solve problems, not the cause. People with encyclopedic knowledge got it through years of problem solving. When Linus Pauling died, he was the greatest chemist in the history of the world. He knew more about chemistry than anyone who ever lived. He didn't get up in the morning and memorize the periodic table. He tried to solve every problem in the field of chemistry over the years. Study doesn't work. Problem solving works. That's where knowledge is permanent. Reading works. The public believes first you get the skills, you practice them over and over again until they're automatic, and then you go over to higher levels. First you learn the facts, first you learn the concepts, and then you can apply them. It's a delayed gratification model, in other words. We are going the other way around. We have reversed cause and effect. Practically nobody but us thinks this is true, even though in their daily life they ignore skill building. Most people believe in skills. If you believe in skill building, if you believe in behaviorism, which most people do, Skinner has won. Alfie Cohn points out it's a rusty version of behavioralism, and even the behaviorists don't believe it, okay? But if you believe in that, everything Arne Duncan is doing makes sense. We need kids to study. We need scope and sequence. Describe the skills. Teach them in order. Common sense. Teachers won't teach. Students won't study unless we do rewards and punishments. So that is common sense. It turns out it's false. It's absolutely false. But the public doesn't know this. This is our biggest enemy. Not simply corporate greed. That's a big part of it. But it's facilitated by the public's belief in skill building. If we're going to change public opinion, we have to go for that. We have to educate the public. Now, how do we do it? I have a model. I have a revolutionary plan. Okay? Now, any revolutionary plan should not require sacrifice, should not require time, and should not put you in personally. It should be easy. I have several steps of the plan, and I think the first two steps might be sufficient. Step number one, inform yourself. I know you don't have time. You want the quickest way? I gave it to you. SusanOhania.org. If you're going to do one thing, get on her mailing list. I'll put it up again. Get on her mailing list. When 100,000 people are on this mailing list, we will have done it. SusanOhania.org. I introduced her at a talk once by Legal Association, and I quoted Gandhi, who said, "One perfect resistor is enough to win the war against evil." Here we go. This will put you right at the center of gravity. You get all the information. She lists the letters to the editor of the week. She has the outrage of the day. Daily outrages, two different outrage columns, good quotes. It's all there, and you'll see you're not the only one facing these problems. That's step number one. The other thing I say, get on Twitter. Follow me. Follow Alfie Cohn. Follow Diane Ravitch. Follow Susan Ohanian. That's step one. Twitter's great for these quick little communications. Number two, share it. If you're on Twitter, retweet to your friends. See, I retweet Diane Ravitch, Alfie Cohn, all the time. I get it. I have about 2,000 people on my Twitter, and they get my stuff. By the way, Facebook, I'm not very active on Facebook. I really haven't gotten into it. But I discovered a year ago, that there's a Steve Krashen fan club. Some guy in Turkey started. I checked it out. It had 65 members. 30 were my relatives. Another 5 were my daughter's girlfriends. kind of my honorary nieces. I've known since they were little kids.
So much for that.
And I was getting into a lot of trouble. Why don't you respond? I asked the guy to take it down because I wasn't keeping track. So those things are very quick. Share it. You see a good item in the paper, share it. Share it with 3 or 4 friends. It's all you need to do. You will have 6 degrees of separation. The internet is our way. I still believe in going after politicians. I do it all the time. I always send my local Democratic Party politicians everything I do. One of them is on the Education Committee. They ignore it. I've talked to them. They still ignore it. They send me back increased letters about what they've done and how they need my contributions. That's about it. Okay. But I still do it. Politicians are influenced by their staff, and their staff tells them what they want, what they think they want. That's the problem. My local representative of the state government, her education advisor, is a local real estate person once taught me. He's no longer into it. The media, I recommend going to the media. Absolutely. I continuously go. I send letters in, etc. I don't write to reporters. I've discovered they get annoyed when you do that. But I make sure everything is out there so they can. I regularly contribute to a blog called Schools Matter. They've invited me to put my stuff on it, and I send things out on my mailing list. Artie Duncan had written an article, or someone in his staff wrote an article in the Washington Post, and he said some things that I thought were totally outrageous, as usual, that we have succeeded in lifting schools from poverty. And my response was, no, we haven't. No one ever has. All the paper I wrote of this years ago called Don't Trust, Ed Trust. Ed Trust had claimed that all these schools were doing great, and you look at it closely, and they're not doing great. In fact, it's very hard to find any high-flying, high-poverty schools. General Bracey did an expose in the early years of the Harlem Children's Zone, and found they were not doing as well, as they were near as well, as the publicity said. So I said, this is not true. We haven't lived into a school's poverty. There are no studies showing this. Poverty is rough. Number two, he said, everybody loves the new analysis. I said, no, just you and Bill Gates love them. The teachers are not carrying signs or tests, you know. And the new teacher evaluations are necessary, and teachers are reading. No, they're not. This is just a way of, you know, blaming people who shouldn't blame at all. So I said that, and it was on my blog. Valerie Strauss. Now, Valerie Strauss does a blog for the Washington Post called The Answer Sheet. She's very good. She picked it up. CNN read it. When Arnie Duncan was on CNN, Wolf Blitzer asked my question. This was my 30 seconds of fame, okay? And Duncan just kept talking. He said, well, Krashen says you haven't done it. He says, yes, we have. We have the Harvard Children's, you know, blah, 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 yes. The teachers love all this stuff. What are you talking about? So he just kept moving. So the press is, even at best, it's very hard to influence them. A lot of reporters are sincere, but they're overworked. Other reporters have attention deficit disorder. There's a lot of arrogance among reporters. So I do all these things, but it's not enough. We have to go right to the public. And our way of doing it is the internet. We have the MoveOn.org has been so successful. They did a fabulous job in the Obama campaign. They nearly got Howard Dean nominated all by themselves. Okay? So I think the internet, while we still have it, because we may not have it for much longer. Big business is looking for ways of straining it and making money on it. Let's use it. All I'm recommending is when you see something you like, that anything you think other people would enjoy seeing or need to see or are going to help them, put it on the net. Send it to 5 friends the way you send jokes around. They will pass it around. I follow John Wooden's advice. Don't let what you can't do stop you from doing what you can do. I think that this first step, doing a little reading, not much, just seeing what Susan Ahinian posts. Yeah, they're very short. And occasionally sharing something might be enough. Eventually, it will swamp the country. Actually, there are enough people in this room that if everybody did it, we would probably get 200,000 paid. Now, that's the first step, maybe enough. The second step is a little more, and I don't think that a lot of people have time and energy to do this because you're overwhelmed, and that is actually contribute. But if I took over your 5th grade class and I helped you for 3 years in class, I still wouldn't know what you need. Teachers have intuitions about kids that we don't have. It would take a decade to build up. So the public needs to hear from teachers. The public needs teachers to post. And I can give you a hierarchy of how to do it and share information. Easy way of doing it, of losing your virginity in this area when you getting the confidence to do more. You read a newspaper article online, it's generally a place for it's online. My library buddies are really good at this. We do this. We pitch in a whole bunch of people do. And Connie's not in, Anna's not in, our mutual friends have done it. And it's very impressive. You send things around, it's nice. It's a vote. Right now, the people who make comments on the internet are the other side. No matter what the issue is, you will see, oh, it's all those immigrants. It's because Obama's a socialist and a foreigner. let's treat him with the respect all foreigners deserve when he gives speech. You know, this kind of stuff. No, our side needs to be represented. That's a good way of getting started. Writing makes you smart. When you write it down, you get a clearer idea of what you're talking about. You can handle conversations better. Then you can go to the short article, and you can short notes, and you can local newspapers, newsletters, whatever. Contributing to professional magazines, etc. Our view needs to be represented. People who publish are the university people or the administrators on their behalf, and most of them don't get it. So it's time the public heard from our voice. Okay, I've covered everything that was on the card. People forget that George Bush started all this crap. He's the one who got us in trouble by basically stealing all the money from the government and giving it to his friends. That's what he did for 8 years, okay? In fact, it's one of the most magnificent economic accomplishments ever in the history of the human race. He took our money and gave it to his buddies, and wide open. The economy was going down, down, down. Obama came in, and it's like turning around a huge ship. You see this, you see this, you see this, which is fabulous, but because it hasn't streaked up, the other side is very critical.
And that's, okay? I think, education to change the tenor of the conversation would be a huge task, and he's got other things on his plate.
He's got other things on his plate, but right now, he's going absolutely in the wrong direction. It's been a disaster. The people in charge of education haven't a clue of schools. Arne Duncan, let me give you his background. Grew up in Chicago, and his whole educational experience is playing basketball with children in poverty at his mother's tutoring center. That's it. He then went off to Harvard, majored in sociology, was captain of the basketball team, tried out for the pros, didn't make it, played professional basketball for 4 years in Australia. When he came back to Chicago, he was immediately appointed the president of an educational foundation. What? This is weird. Nobody's commented on this. Turns out, Mom worked with Barack Obama when he was a community organizer. Arne plays basketball with Michelle's brother and the president. From this organization, he then went to Chicago City Schools. He worked his way up to CEO, they call it, superintendent, and went to the White House. He instituted common sense, crowd-pleasing, feel-good changes in Chicago, none of which worked. Yeah, shutting down schools, all that stuff. So this is what we've got. He has a staff of people who basically have no idea. I've talked to his assistant, Peter Cunningham. I didn't get anywhere. I mean, we weren't even in the same discourse. You look at the people on his staff. These are public policy people, very few people who have any background in education. I criticized Obama when he was in the Senate education. He gave a speech to the American Library Association, which made the cover, and they loved it. But he basically said, turn off the TV. We need more discipline. None of which has any basis in the research and reality. So he's always been out of it in education. He's got the same attitude that a lot of East Coast-type college people have, Yale background and all this, about education. So we're not getting anywhere. We have not penetrated the administration. Phonemic awareness is the ability to take a sound, a syllable, and break it into its sounds. How many of you have heard of phonemic awareness? Okay, if I had asked this 15 years ago, two hands would have gone up. Nobody knew about it then. Now everybody thinks you've got to do it or kids will never learn to read. How did they learn to read 15 years ago? So this is all new. I want to give you a phonemic awareness exercise. I'm going to give you a word. I'd like you to strip away the initial consonant and tell me what's left. You ready, David? Okay. Pit. Pit. Very good. Split. Split. Let me tell you how you did that. You spelled the word in your mind's eye, right? You took off the S and you pronounced what's left. What I've just demonstrated is that phonemic awareness is the result of knowing how to read, not the cause. Beyond the most elementary phonemic awareness activity, you can't do them unless you're literate. There has been, again, a cause-effect fusion. Everybody develops phonemic awareness. You can help it if you read nearly everybody. Let me give you the absolute data, though. I spent quite a bit of time on this because the National Reading Panel decided phonemic awareness was where it's at. Got to do it. They do a lot of studies, and they show that these are comparison studies. One group gets phonemic awareness training, okay? And they find that with phonemic awareness training, you know, they strip away initial consonants and all this, and this is a big deal. It sells a lot of kits. This helps you, and it does, do better on tests of phonemic awareness. I did a study looking at all the studies that the National Reading Panel did to see if phonemic awareness helped reading comprehension. I looked at immediate tests, delayed tests later on. I found practically nothing. There were like 16 comparisons. Only one showed a clear advantage. It was done in Israel with 15 children learning to read Hebrew. The effect of phonemic awareness has only been shown to be positive in one study in Hebrew in Israel. I published this in the Psychology, which meant the reading people didn't see it, but I managed to slip it into the Reading Research Quarterly. I was misquoted, fortunately. And I wrote a letter to the editor, and I wasn't worried about the misquote or anything, but I managed to slip all this stuff in and cite my psychology article. The national reading panel responded, and they agreed with me. They said, yeah, there isn't too much evidence for phonetic awareness affecting reading, but if we had more studies, maybe there'd be more. This should be published in a new journal called Duffer. Yeah, of course. You know, who knows? You know, maybe not. In other words, they conceded the point. Of course, that didn't stop anybody. They still keep pushing it. Another thing that is against the case of phonemic awareness, if you look at these studies, the kids in the control groups get better in phonemic awareness too, without instruction. Not as fast, but they do improve. If you look at children over time, by the time kids are in the third grade, for sure the fourth grade, they're all at the top of the chart on phonemic awareness. Everybody eventually gets it. So, who knows? We also know with adult illiterates, you teach them to read, their phonemic awareness improves. It's the result of reading, not thoughts. Not only that, something like 3/4 of kids with low phonemic awareness learn to read perfectly well. A great study by Rosalie Fink looked at recovered dyslexics later on who learned to read very well. All of them developed a pleasure reading habit in a narrow area that they thought was interesting, and many of them still have phonemic awareness problems. Very good adult readers who have trouble stripping away initial consonants, that totally destroys the case for phonemic awareness. I think it's borderline hoax. I think we're spending a lot of time and money on something that kids develop anyway. If you teach any phonics at all, if kids read at all, develop them. Boy, does that save time. Yeah, unfortunately, we're not getting the support of our professional organizations who are all wanting a seat at the table and are throwing us all under the bus, every single one of them. I've been bawled out by every single professional organization, all of them, okay, everyone I'm associated with. So that's not the answer. What is dangerous is to do what a lot of people tell me. I close the door of the room. I do it, it's right. We read stories, we tell these great things, kids do reading. Our test scores are fantastic, and when the superintendent or the monitoring team comes in, we take out the workbooks. Well, that's great for your students, but the skill builders are getting the credit, so it perpetuates the crime. I say do it. Do the best you can with your kids. Do a little more of what's good, a little less of what's bad. Close the door, do all that. But at the same time, we have to have political action. At the same time. Now, there's no group to join. That's why I went through these steps. Step one, Ohanian, really. Step two, share it. Let's start solving the problem. You know, I tell groups this, and I know who gets on Twitter and all that, and Susan says, oh, I got 4 more from El Paso. You must have been speaking there. Very few people do it. Very few people take this 30 seconds out of the day and do this small thing, pass things along, change public opinion. Don't let what you can't do stop you from doing what you can. Other than that, I have no vast political plans. I know for sure the NCTS for policy recommendations, I doubt if more 3 of us ever send anything. So, of course, they say, see, we have the will of the people. Meanwhile, people are writing long tirades to each other and complaining about what's wrong with the government. I'll go, Mask, we're done. You didn't ask the big question. Where can we find your books, actually? Over there and on Amazon. But I know this
books are on the way out.
Yeah. Okay, here we go.
Thank you. Thank you to Dr. Stephen Krashen for giving us permission to record this address given at the symposium at Mary Collins Charter School in Petaluma this past January. Dr. Stephen Krashen is such an outspoken advocate for children and for teachers, and we thank him for all of his work. His website is 3wsdkrashen.com. That's SDKRASHEN.com. His email address is krashen@usc.edu. On Thursday, March 3rd, Education Now will launch a podcast of an interview we will do with Nancy Williams, co-founder of the Montessori Phoenix Projects. You can check them out online at 3wsmontessoriphoenixprojects.org. That's M-O-N-T-E-S-S-O-R-I-P-H-O-E nixprojects.org. Education Now is a production of the Hermeneutic Institute for Holistic Health and Education, a 501c3 nonprofit corporation. Education Now podcasts are listed on the American Montessori Society website at www.amshq.org under Regional Group Events. All broadcasts can be listened to with free download at this website. Thank you so much for listening.
You are on the road, must have a code that you can live by, and so become yourself, because the past is just a goodbye. Teach your children well, their father's hell did slowly go by, and feed them on your dreams, the one they picked, the one you